Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Good evening, dear guests, and welcome to Gay for Page. So we're meeting tonight on the Eora Nation of the Gadigal people, who've been telling stories on this land since time immemorial. The sovereignty of this land was never ceded, and we occupy it tonight as settlers. And I want to remind non-Indigenous people in the audience our role as settlers to continue to dismantle ongoing colonisation. And I want to pay my respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders past and present, and anyone we have in the room here tonight. Let's say it all together. Always was, always will be. That's right. We are in for an absolute treat tonight. It's not often you get to host or be on a panel of seven authors. I'm really excited. Did anyone come to Gay for Page last year? That's really reassuring because I hosted it last year. If no one had come back, it would have been bad for the audience interaction, but it also would have been a terrible start to the evening. So thank you for coming back. My name's Sally Rugg. I am an activist and a writer, and during the day, I am the executive director of Change.org. I'm also nearly finished writing a book about like the dirty politics and the campaign secrets of the marriage equality campaign, which I'm sure you're really excited to buy in September. Thanks in advance. So we are going to introduce ourselves and then we'll have a chat for about an hour, and then we'll do questions at the end for half an hour, which is heaps of time. Great. So because our panel is like truly extraordinary and I'm a little bit too intimidated to introduce everybody, we're going to do it in a bit of a round robin. I'm going to kick us off by introducing the wonderful Geordie Rosenberg. Geordie Rosenberg is the author of Confessions of the Fox, a New York Times Editor's Choice Selection. The book was a finalist for the Centre for Fiction First Novel Prize, a Lambda Literary Award, and a Publishing Triangle Award. Confessions has been recognised by outlets such as The New Yorker, The Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, Kirkus Reviews, Lit Hub, and Electric Literature as one of the best books of 2018. Geordie is a professor of 18th century literature, gender and sexuality studies, and critical theory at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Please make Geordie welcome.
Okay, and I'm going to be introducing Nivea Corneliuson. Nivea Corneliuson was born in 1990 in Nuuk and grew up in South Greenland. She spent a year in California as an exchange student. Corneliuson started writing in 2013 and is the winner of many writing competitions in Greenland, where her debut novel, Crimson, was first published under the title Homo Sapien. Did I pronounce that correctly? Which she translated herself from Greenlandic to Danish and was nominated for a Politiken Literary Award. Literary Award and the Nordisk Council Literature Prize. In a New Yorker article titled The Young Queer Writer Who Became Greenland's Unlikely Literary Star, the magazine called Crimson a work of a strikingly modern sensibility, a stream of consciousness story of five queer protagonists confronting their identities in 21st century Greenlandic culture.
Sounds very impressive.
You are very impressive. Okay, that's okay.
No, it's okay.
Unlike Brian.
Yeah. Brian Washington, sitting, yes, very next to you. Yeah. Brian Washington has written for The New Yorker, the New York Times, The New York Times Magazine. Okay, The Paris Review, Tin House, BuzzFeed, Bon Appetit, TQ, Vulture, Fader, The All, Catapult, and Munchies. His debut collection of stories, Lud, is set in his hometown of Houston and is the confession of a neighborhood channeled through a literary prodigy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be introducing Andrew Sean Greer, who is sitting opposite of me. Andrew Sean Greer is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of 6 works of fiction, including the bestsellers The Confessions of Max Tivoli and Less. Andrew has taught at a number of universities, including the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He's been a Today Show pick, a New York Public Library Coleman Center Fellow, a judge for the National Book Award, and a winner of the California Book Award and the New York Public Library Young Lions Award. And he is the recipient of an NEA grant, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for Less. He also lives in San Francisco.
Alexander Chi is the best-selling author, this is Alexander Chi, of the novels The Queen of the Night and Edinburgh. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, an editor-at-large at Virginia Quarterly Review, and a critic-at-large at the Los Angeles Times. His work has appeared in The Best American Essays 2016, The New York Times Magazine, Slate, Guernica, and Tin House, among others. He's an associate professor of English at Dartmouth College. How to Write an Autobiographical Novel is an essay collection exploring his education as a man, writer, and activist, and how we form our identities in life and in art. It was named a best book of 2018 by Publishers Weekly, Time Magazine, New York Magazine, and The Washington Post, among others. As a novelist, Alexander Chi has been described as masterful by Roxane Gay and incendiary by the New York Times, and I have known Alexander Chi since we were 19 years old. Very recently.
Tell us some things that Alexander did at 19.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Maybe later.
We'll get to that. Casey Legler. Casey Legler is an artist, yes. Model, restaurateur, and a former Olympic swimmer. Born in France to expatriate American parents, Casey grew up in Provence and went on to swim for France in the 1996 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. The first woman signed to Ford Models to exclusively model men's clothes, Casey has been featured in Vogue, Le Monde, and Time. New York Times called their memoir Godspeed, raw and poetic, lean and ferocious.
And I get to introduce my friend Holly. And we've shared a bunch of coffees together at Cornersmith in Merrickville when we both lived there, which is really fun. So Holly Throsby is a musician and novelist from Sydney. She's released 5 solo albums, a collection of original children's songs, and an album as part of the band Seeker, Lover, Keeper with Sarah Blasco and Sally Seltman. Holly has been nominated for 4 ARIAs. Holly's debut novel, Goodwood, was a critically acclaimed bestseller, shortlisted for numerous awards, and her second novel, Cedar Valley, was published to rave reviews, and you've been longlisted for the Indie Book Award. Holly! Give it up for Holly!
Give it up for the entire panel. What an incredible panel we have here tonight. A little bit of housekeeping. If you're enjoying yourself tonight, please let the panelists know. We want lots of clapping and laughing or booing. No booing. And also the bar is open and we would love it if you would get up and up and down to the bar all the time. In fact, as a favour to me, please do get up and down to the bar all the time. Here we go. Round of applause. Just modelling some great behaviour. So tonight we have a panel of incredible LGBT authors and we're going to be talking about the queer texts and characters and authors who inspired us. Maybe they were explicitly queer, maybe they weren't. And so I've spoken to each of you in the lead up to this panel and people threw these sort of ideas into the ring. And having a look at all of them together, the first thing that kind of jumped out at me of all the texts and characters that you all put forward was there was this, the theme that kept popping up was the idea of belonging and of loneliness. And kind of like perhaps being an outcast and that is your power or your as well as your Achilles heel, that sort of idea. And Jordi, I wanted to throw to you first, because one of the texts you wrote to me about was called I and Gomorrah, and I wanted to ask you about that text and what it meant to you, and can you tell us about the text as well?
Okay, well, I just want to begin by saying what an error it is to begin with me, how horrified I am about this. It's fine. The reason it's such an error is that I had been hoping that everyone would say, like, cheery things, and then I could come along later and just talk about abjection and terror, and also, like, a lot about urine, strangely. And so, but no, we're starting with that. So I'll just start with that. There's no way to spin this differently. I'm also going to slightly dodge the question, which had something to do with when I first encountered I and Gomorrah, or that's how it was posed to me before that. I'll not talk that much about, or anything at all, really, about who I was at this moment. I was probably in my late teens, and I was inhabiting kind of a pre-butch lesbian moment where I did not understand myself as a lesbian, or this was a very foreclosed concept to me, but I was very drawn to lesbian and especially very butch accoutrements. So, like, very butch clothing, and often I would be sort of walking through the house and then sort of sprung upon by my mother, is how I periodize everything, who would say something like, no matter how big your belt buckle is, you'll never be a man. So something like that. So, which was like a strange, very puzzling to me, because I wasn't even really even thinking about that. And in fact, it turned out to be untrue. But at any rate, but rather than talk about me, I think this moment where you kind of are like pre-identifying as anything has been described very well, and you'll excuse me for using some notes because I want to get these quotes right, by the theorist Jose Munoz in his 1999 book, Disidentifications, and he describes this moment of being very young and seeing a video of Truman Capote on TV, and he describes a very swishy Truman Capote, and he says that he was very terrified at this kind of recognition of some aspect of himself. But the terror that Munoz is describing isn't this like simple repulsion, it's this far more ambivalent experience where Munoz also says he felt like total terror at seeing Capote, but also this kind of deep pleasure of watching Capote, and the quote is, make language. So there's something very interesting to me about this idea of like a disidentificatory moment of a subject position, but like real erotic compulsion towards seeing that abjected object, that horrifying object that is probably you, or is going to be you, make language. And I think I had kind of an experience of that with Delaney's I and Gomorrah. I don't know if anyone here has read this very short story. It's from 1966. And it won a Nebula Award in 1966, which is a really important science fiction award. And it is about, it was a very disturbing story to me. It's about a group of interstellar workers called spacers who do kind of extraterrestrial infrastructure work, like labor, manual labor. And nobody wants to do this work because the radiation from space destroys your gonads. So they're kind of androgenized, these spacers. But we don't really see them in space. We see them, they keep coming down to Earth and landing. And when they land, they also continue to work. They do kind of sex work. And they do sex work with people who we might understand to be tranny chasers, actually not a category that bothers me personally as a trans person, I thank God for these people. But if they're femme, but at any rate, not the point. What these people are called in Delaney's book are called frelks, and it's actually a very cool thing. They're people with free fall sexual displacement complex. They have like a fetish for these androgens who kind of tumble through space. And I think I was very horrified at the idea that I was this androgen who tumbled through space, but I also was very moved by the way that Delaney, and he does this throughout his oeuvre, connects queer bodies and queer embodiment, and in particular, I promise I would talk about urine, like bodily queer bodily effluvia with outer space. And he makes this space for racialized bodies and queer bodies to kind of find this world in outer space. That was very mesmerizing to me to kind of see him do. And there's this one quote that I wanted to read from Delaney. He says, science fiction casts a language shadow over areas of imaginative space that would otherwise be largely inaccessible. And you have to really just marvel at his ability to place queer and racialized bodies in that space and to allow us to build these kind of dream architectures. And I think that was very moving to me. I could actually go on, but I won't, more about this, but I think that was something that really, really resonated with me was watching him make language and specifically genre language in that way.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks, mate. As you were speaking, I was rudely sort of scribbling away because I thought, Brian, one of the things you sent me was a film called Akira, which is, when I research, it's kind of this cyberpunk things in a dystopia, and I was wondering if anything that Geordie was saying just then resonated with you in terms of sort of like science fiction and how you interpret.
Yeah, hell yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, when I think of Delaney, I immediately correlate it with, like, did you read, I mean, I'm sure you've read it, like, that interview with Rachel Kazyganza for the Paris Review that he'd done, and I think that was, like, one of the first times that I'd come across a black queer author who was writing about other worlds, right? Like, even though, you know, I grew up in, like, the fucking 90s, so most of the media that I was taking, it was mid-aughts sort of things, but, you know, we weren't overly inundated with queer narratives with black and brown folks, and we certainly weren't over inundated with, I don't want to say positive, but queer narratives with black and brown folks where everyone didn't die or like they didn't get together at the end and then like, oh, now you have cancer, like you're gone, that sort of thing. So, you know, Delaney's work was pretty pivotal for me. As far as Akira is concerned, I mean, it was originally a comic by Katsuhiro Otomo, and I came across it in a sort of peripheral way. I feel like if I'm going to talk about Akira, I should also talk about like fan fiction, which maybe a handful of people in this room have dabbled in and or know about. But the practice, just like a shorthand, like the practice of someone who is not the creator of a work, who is a sort of injecting themselves into that work and then writing it for an audience of themselves or their peers. And that was something I came across when I was like junior high school, because I wasn't the biggest reader, right? And it was important to me in the sense that I wasn't seeing the bodies and the faces and the folks that I wanted to see and the relationships that I had wanted to see. And fan fiction created a sort of space for those narratives to be created. And fan fiction was also really pivotal because it delineated the idea of like what I thought an author could look like, right? I did not see too many black or brown queer authors in American literary fiction, specifically contemporary American literary fiction. But you know, if you like fucking log on to the Google and you see what's happening with fan fiction, there are quite a lot of people who are writing quite a lot of things that you'd be interested in. For
what fan fiction did you kind of cut your teeth on?
I shouldn't say.
I think you need to.
No, it's going to be like a fucking riot. No, I think that there's... like the pivot is just sort of like intellectual pivot. I think that...
But
narratives like Akira, narratives like Banana Fish, which was another comic that sort of made its way over to the States, narratives where you would have two cis men, because I'm deeply interested in the relationship between men and boys and how those relationships either contract under duress, whether it's platonic or sexual, or whether they expand and what that expansion looks like and what that contraction looks like, yeah? And the
sort of scope of like what fan fiction is. It allows for a lot of play with that, right? So like you could take the Marvel Universe, let's say, because that fucking movie just came out. You could have any number of characters in that, and you could just sort of create your own world within that world. And that was really special to me, and it was sort of how I learned to write, so to speak, and with a community of folks who were doing like-minded work and work that I was deeply interested in for the work's sake, right? And I think that it was really instrumental for me, because when I first started writing, I was writing those narratives, and they were narratives that I wanted to write for the sake of writing them in lieu of like what might be profitable for like the marketplace, let's say, or like what is currently in the New Yorker, let's say, or like what I know is going to sell, although you really can't say that about most queer narratives in American literary fiction. So it was so being able to play with those different universes was really important to me, and I think that reading Delaney was one of the venues that really opened that world up for me.
I wish I'd known about Delaney.
What's that?
No, I was just saying, I wish I'd known about Delaney, because as you were talking, I was remembering, I think I told you about this like moment when I was 20. I think we're about the same age, but but I was 20, and I'd just gotten sober and ended up in a therapist's office, and I wish I'd known about this narrative of kind of like these gonadless humans kind of floating down from space, because I remember very seriously sitting across from her and saying, and you know, I had no language around queerness or being gay or being butch or being a dyke or being trans, or like I had no language for my body, which is why this panel's so exciting. But I told her, surely there are men out there with no penises. Like, I just was very serious with her about this inquiry, because I didn't identify as a woman, and I did not have the genitals, although I have, you know, some I can take on and off now, right? But it's just like, but I was very, and, you know, the end result of that therapy session is that I didn't go back, so her reaction must have been, you know, unremarkable or, you know,
horrified.
She hadn't read
the book either.
No, she had definitely not read the book, because then she would have said, well, in outer space, actually, are where your people are, which is, I think, not untrue, right? Yeah. So anyway, so I love that. Anyway, I wish I had known that as a young person, but I got so much out of that, yeah.
I should have mentioned that although we never see these spacers in space, where the first like launch pad where they come down to Earth is in a toilet, is in a bathroom. And that,
which is like,
that's the
nightmare.
Key, actually. Yeah, right. No, it's a beautiful abjection, because it's the hinge between outer space and this earthboundedness to which, in certain ways, you know, we've been consigned, because in many ways, queer people have not been permitted to write science fiction or in 1966, right? But the hinge is the toilet. And of course, this has so many resonances with men's cruising.
So many.
But it's just like the abjection of our bodies. The effluvia is also the route to something exhilarating, I think. So
I'm going to stay on this side of the stage just so we almost tip over. But Holly,
hi guys.
Yeah, hey, we'll get you
in the second act.
You should have come on stage afterwards. But Holly, it's not quite as extreme as like losing your gonads in a labor camp of out of space. But I want you to tell me about the character of Frankie in The Member of the Wedding, who is like quite a tomboy character, and she's trying to negotiate how she grows up in that identity.
It's not a gonad situation.
No, but it was a good segue.
Yeah, that's
good job. Valerie.
I feel like together we made it work. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I nominated The Member of the Wedding, which is a novel by Carson McCullers, which I read when I was a teenager, and it had a really profound effect on me. And it's not a queer book, but I kind of think it really could be, or maybe is, secretly. I really over-identified with Frankie, who's this 12-year-old girl in the book. It was written in the sort of a mid-century Southern Gothic kind of coming-of-age story, but it's really sad. And Frankie is this total tomboy. She, like, throws knives as her hobby. And I thought that was so cool that I got a set of throwing knives and tried to learn how to throw knives. It's not easy.
Do you have to Is there a special set? You have to get special knives?
Yeah, you get throwing knives, like they're weighted and they have a... you can get all different kinds. The ones that I have, maybe it's their fault that I am not that great at throwing knives. Because I felt like Lou Diamond Phillips made it look really easy in Young Guns and I thought it would be that easy. And then also knife throwing has kind of stayed with me because then by the time I was in my 20s and I saw that French film called The Girl on the Bridge... and Vanessa Paradis is in it, and she's this suicidal nymphomaniac who becomes the assistant to a knife thrower, which means that he throws the knives at her, and it's incredibly erotic. And by that stage, I realised, I had kind of come to the realisation that I wanted to kind of throw knives at Vanessa Paradis. but when I was younger, when I was a teenager and reading The Member of the Wedding, I had no idea about that kind of thing. Like I didn't, as like you, Casey, I didn't have any language and I didn't know any queer people whatsoever. And I just really really related to her, and the whole story is that she's obsessed with her brother and his upcoming wedding, which is happening in like a day, to this woman, and Frankie just wants to be like a part of their wedding, and then she wants to go on the honeymoon, and she has this kind of really awkward fantasy that she's going to go on the honeymoon, and the servant, the black servant, because it's very much set in that sort of southern time, is sort of saying, you're delusional, you can't go to the wedding, you can't go on the honeymoon, and she doesn't really understand how inappropriate it is, and I guess it really killed me. And I think now looking at it, it is such a queer narrative because she's trying to be part of this kind of heteronormative unit, like she wants to be kind of, and she doesn't realise in a kind of pre-identifying way that she doesn't belong in that, and that she's kind of has to carve out, I guess, a separate space for herself, which is really separate to this kind of heteronormative fantasy that she has. And so when I look at it now, it does strike me as kind of a queer book.
And so when you read it at the time, it wasn't leaping off the page as a queer narrative?
No, not at all, even though, it has some slightly subversive sort of gender themes in terms of, I mean, I guess because she's a tomboy, but there's one conversation she has where she says that if she could wish anything, it would be that girls and boys could swap and a girl could become a boy and go back to being a girl just easily at will. And I mean, Carson McCullers, as far as I know, wasn't queer. I mean, she had male partners. Who knows what she did in her private life? But it's quite a rich text, I think, to kind of relook at. And I'm like, now looking back, I kind of wonder if those are the reasons it resonated so much with me.
Yeah, totally. So, Andrew, thank you for that, by the way. So,
you're
my
welcome,
next question.
Sally.
What did you say?
I said you're welcome.
And thank you all for coming.
Feel free to get a drink at any time.
Yeah, please get a drink. Because the thing, we've all got drinks on stage, but I was kind of taking the cue from the audience. Did you bring your beer up? Okay, great.
I had one sip before.
You had one sip? Okay. All right, okay, cool.
Accept drinks also.
Yes.
Yeah. So I imagine that across the panel we've each got different experiences of... being closeted or knowing we were gay or queer from a really young age. And like Holly, you were saying, like looking back on text and being like, fuck, like that makes sense. But perhaps there's some of us who knew all along and were kind of seeking out those characters from an early age. And Andrew, one of the books you sent me was In the Night Kitchen. And I wanted you to tell me about this because it's a kid's book. And I wondered if you'd read it when you were a little kid.
Well, yes.
And the words you said were, it messed me up.
It feels funny to talk about a kid's book because I'm talking about a book that my mother would read, a picture book, would read to me when I was 4. And it really, that's like my first memory. And have you read In the Night Kitchen by Maurice Sendak? He sort of has a dream and he goes and gets covered in dough and then...
But he's naked.
Yes, and then he goes into milk and then he's naked. And you see his penis. And
but
I was like,
little child.
Holy fuck. As a 4-year-old, I was like, it's still, I was sitting here thinking about it. I was like, I don't know why I wrote that to you now, because now I have to sit and talk about this.
I'm going to change it. I changed my mind.
It's too late. She brought it up. Out of the whole list I gave her, she went in the night kitchen.
It was the shortest book. I was like, I picked that one.
It's true. Yeah. It was, I mean, I have to say, it was sexy. And I was four. And it's weird. It's, we don't think about children as being sexual in some way, but I can definitely pinpoint it. And there's something about it, like, I wanted to be the naked boy. I liked looking at the naked boy. It was something. And it was, this is the time when my parents sent me to therapy, in fact, actually, yeah, because I would draw my family as like a man, a woman, a little boy, and a little girl. I have a twin brother. It was two boys. And I was a little girl because I guess I thought, well, if I like this boy, then the rule is that I'm the girl. That made sense to me. And I remember it being cool with that. My parents were not. But like, it's I can't quite connect. It's that book did it. But I just would look at it over and over and over. And I think it was controversial. Of course, I didn't read the news, but like it was banned. And
the chefs kind of smother him in dough, and then he shoots off in a plane. And like, it's all very, it's quite a visceral story. I don't know. I read it and I got it.
You got it.
From your point of view.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just imagine reading that as a child and being quite enchanted with it.
Well, and I was also thinking that I think I'm old enough that as a kid and a teenager, I didn't have contact with enough literal queer texts that I could identify. And so I would sort of queer things wherever I found them, you know? Like, I would just in a sort of, you know, not very campy way, but like, you know what I mean. Yeah, you would just find it. And the way you would look through a book and you'd look for the some sexy scene, or like those Valley of the Horses books, like Clan of the Cave Bear felt gay to me somehow.
Did you read those?
Oh, did I read those?
I read those when I was 10 in the library, and I was like,
it's just, God. And you're flipping, and you're like, okay, mammoth, okay, John DeLar.
You did that too? Yes. You skipped ahead? I did too to the sex scenes. I was like,
I would do that. I remember reading like,
and they're like
Gorby Doll's creation and being like, Gorby Doll, but there's a Greek scene coming up. You know, you go through history.
Now, Alexander, is this why you were really into Alexander the Great?
Well,
Is that for the same reason?
I can't tell. So just in case, I was named for Alexander the Great, and it always seemed kind of a silly thing early on, and then I got really into Greek mythology. And it seemed slightly less silly, and then I found the novels of Mary Renault, young, like I think I was 12, and. In particular, her novels about Alexander the Great, and then the sort of the one where I knew I was really in it was called The Persian Boy, which is told from the point of view of his lover, who is a slave, a Persian slave, that kind of. I was like, well, I have been well named. and so I always felt this kind of weird entitlement to my sexuality as a result, where I was like, yeah, tradition.
Great.
Comes with the name. Anyway, you know, like it just, I mean, I did have some, it's not to say it was entirely uncomplicated, but it really changed something in me to read that.
Mm-hmm. But did you also go and look through books for sort of like glorious pictures of Alexander the Great winning battles?
not until later. And then I found one thing that was really interesting to discover was the Alexandrine romances, which are these like over 1,000 years of stories about Alexander the Great doing all of these things, including like going under the water, which apparently inspired Jacques Cousteau to commit to creating underwater living experiences. So it's which is also a fascination of mine, is my father was a diver, and my father was on the Tech Tide 2 underwater living experiment. So it all seemed to kind of like weave together. And I was thinking later then, like, is that why he named me Alexander the Great? You know, but because I never knew that. He died before I could ask him what his purpose was. You know, he named my brother after Christopher Columbus. So I guess we know that there was certain aspirational quality. Yeah. No pressure. No pressure. Oh. Conquer the world. Discover, you know.
He would be very proud. Yeah. I don't know you that well, but I assume.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, Nivek, I imagine you didn't grow up with a whole bunch of queer literature because your book, Crimson, was the first queer book ever published in Greenland. Wow. And so I imagine it is, you know, that book is now speaking to a whole generation of young LGBT people over there. But in lieu of books or stories, what did you turn to or what did you find?
Well, it was very hard growing up without literature. I was reading books. I remember reading books from the States about white girls that are straight. And it was very difficult for me because I knew I liked reading, but I couldn't read anything that said anything to me at all. Mm-hmm. It was like a whole different world, and even like literature from Denmark, which is our how do you say it in English? I have no idea. We were colonized by Denmark.
Colonized, yeah.
Or colonizers, yeah. Back then. Even literature from Denmark didn't say anything to me. So I grew up like with a national TV with like selected movies. We didn't have access to the internet. And so I had no idea what it meant to be gay. So I grew up in a very small island actually with 1,500 people. And there were actually no gay people there, or they didn't say anything. They weren't out of the closet. So I grew up like not knowing what it meant to be gay. And I remember when I moved to the States, and my very conservative host mom, I'm sorry, asked me, "Are you gay?" And I was like, "What does that mean?" Mm-hmm. So I wasn't introduced to that in the States, of course, because it's she didn't like it. I don't think she liked it. I said, "No, I'm not." But then I moved to a bigger city in Greenland, and I wrote this short story about. Because I knew I was gay, even though I didn't really know what it meant to be gay. I wrote this short story about two women who fall in love. And then I was invited to a festival in Sweden. I'm not going to say any words. I'm not going to mention any words because I'm going to tell you a secret later on. And then I was invited to this literature festival. And then I sat down like a very small poetry room where a lot of authors came in and out to read poetry. And then this beautiful lady came up the stage. And she read a poem about structural racism and about being gay. And I was just blown away. And she was really the first person, she was the first person to introduce me to literature that said anything to me. So she made a very, very big impression on me. I'm not gonna say who, because I kissed her late on. So.
I was waiting for that. I was like, and. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It is.
We love kissing. Let's talk about kissing. Let's talk about sex. Casey.
My name is the first name up here. She's like, it has written sex in bold, and then Casey gets the first question.
That's right. Will you tell me about macho sluts?
Yeah.
So, what was it like reading that?
Right? Yes. Okay, good. So machos, like I said, I was very wordless as a young, so I got sober and immediately understood that I was gay. Like it was like within the same day. I put drinks, drugs down and I was like, oh my God. And everyone's like, oh, you know, would it have been good for like adults to be around you, you know, whatever, whatever. And I was like, I just wish someone had told me I was gay, you know, or like queer or that I liked ladies, you know. So
So I was in D.C. at the time. As a sidebar, I was in D.C. at this school because no university in the United States would take me back, and this is the only school who would let me go to their school. So I was a great young adult, really well-behaved. And so I ended up at this school, and I was in training because I was swimming, and I was, you know, there were these two, like, very butch dykes that would sit together. This is 1998. That would sit together in the cafeteria, and I knew I was gay, but I was like, but then, like, being gay requires, like, an action, and I just was like, do I go talk to them? What do I do? And meanwhile, I'm thinking, like, nobody knows I'm gay, but I'm wearing all men's clothes, have a shaved head, like, weigh 225 pounds, and I'm just like, fuck it, you know? And so I'm like, squirreling around being like, ah! And I find macho sluts. And so Pat Califia and I would go on these swimming training trips, and we'd drive from DC down to Florida for our summer, you know, for training or whatever. And I'd be in the van with all of these, like, straighty 180s, other athletes. And, you know, I loved reading, so I read a lot. And they're like, oh, what are you reading? And I'm like, macho sluts. You know? And what I loved about it is because it was about sex, you know? It was also the first time that I had exposure to queer theory. I also understood kind of like the structures of power dynamics and desire, like being in touch with like dark, gritty, bright, colorful, playful desire. What consent meant was also really something that I learned in macho sluts. And what it meant to have, like, everyone participating in this kind of, like, very... And I screen-grabbed some text because I, too, was like, oh, well, things... But my phone's over there with my wife, unless she can, like, throw it at me, and I'll catch it in a way that's, like, really dramatic.
That's
your
wife?
But, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, well,
thanks, Siri.
Thank you, Siri. But I want to read this, like, one bit. That's my tattoo. I just got a bowerbird tattooed on my back.
It's half-naked photo just opened on your screen.
Oh, sex. You know? But hold on. How cool is that? That's on my back.
It's very cool. We'll just put it up on the...
It's massive. It hurt so badly. But this is the stuff that's in Macho Sluts, and I'm reading it as a 21-year-old who's like... I don't even know if I've kissed a girl at this point. I mean, I have, but I was intoxicated. So she says, I'm kissing you too hard, she whispered, and released me. And so this is a femme with a butch. So I also understood femmes and butches, and I was like, whoa, like, what is going on? You know, like, butch accoutrements. I was like, yes, okay. And so it says, she says, I'm kissing you too hard, she whispered, and released me. I can take rougher treatment than that, I murmured, like in typical butch response, like, I got it, you know, it's cool. And laid my cheek on her shoulder, and she twisted her hand in my hair and forced me to look at her. There was something like pity in her eyes, then that was replaced by a predatory joy. Can you really, she threatened. So there was like, in one sentence, all of this like play of just consent, actually. There's nothing more than that. It says, I can play any game you can come up with. This butch, again, that's kind of like, you know, being queer cavalier. And the femme says, but I'm not playing. I considered carefully. If anyone changes their mind, it will be you, I promised quietly. And I'll end it there, but clearly it's not the femme that changes her mind in this story. It's the butch that ends up being like, ah, daddy, please, you know what I mean? So that's what I got from Macho Sluts, was just kind of like this ability to engage in the beginning with my queer family in a physical way, like around the body.
And when you had Macho Sluts and you listed Stone Butch Blues and a whole bunch of others, so well, you had these sort of like overtly queer texts all of a sudden. Mm. Did you think about stuff you'd read before that resonated with you and you were like, oh, this all makes sense? Or was it literally just like lap?
Yeah, no, so I was born and raised in France, and in France they kind of like bring you up on the classics like Kafka, Camus, Proust, and I was reading all of that, and mostly men, mostly straight, white, colonialist French men who wrote kind of like amazing literature that continues to inspire me. And, you know, now it's more like Herta Mueller and Elfriede Jelinek, you know, those writers. I bought your book, by the way. I think for me it was, there wasn't anything I had ever read. Like, there was no room, you know, I came up in sports and there was no language in the 90s if you were an athlete and being queer, and much less if you were a butch human, like, at all. So when I found all of these, I was super, yeah, totally mind blown, completely, yeah.
I want to say Macho Sluts was a huge book for me, too.
Really?
It was, like, more, it somehow made more sense than a lot of the, like, very, like, dark West Village, New York, gay, sexy books.
Why is that?
It was a more joy in it.
Yeah.
Right. And there was a playfulness, and it was dangerous, and it was it felt more contemporary to me than the other. You must have picked that up at the same time I did. When did that book come out?
It came out in 88.
Yeah.
I didn't get it till 98. Yeah. Because I worked at Lambda Rising at a gay bookstore.
I worked at Lambda Rising.
You did? Well, I just have to say an aside, because we're all here, and just a shout out to independent booksellers. But while we were working at Lambda Rising, my wife was working at the Feminist Bookshop here in Sydney, and we have one of the owners of the Feminist Bookshop, Gail Hewison, who's one of our elders. We have to just, like, place, yeah. Shout out to Gail, yeah. Because without Gail and all of the bookshops that made space for us, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but that was where, like, everyone went to cruise. That's where I got the books, like Pat Califia and Dykes to Watch Out For. Like, that was where, unlike, you know, a lot of our folks here who didn't have the opportunity to walk into bookstores.
Oh, my God, that would have been so amazing.
Right?
To walk. Yeah, I know. Like, the books I read from, like, Greenlandic authors who were, like, very old, maybe almost dead dudes, you know. I'm sorry, but our literature, like, the first Greenlandic book, I think, was just a little bit over 100 years ago, so it's still pretty new. So the things they talked about were, like, how to hunt the seal, or, like, the amazing nature and stuff like that. So it was just so dry. So I think I would have been, like, I'm in heaven. Yeah. If I walked into a feminist bookstore, oh my Jesus Christ.
Well, I mean, I don't know what it was like. I don't know what it was like for you guys, but it definitely, I don't know, you're very young. So it's like, so are you, right? It's like, do you know what a bookstore is?
Do I know what it is? There's this Amazon thing. You just log in and they send you
the
fucking
drone
books.
Delivers the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think that libraries on my end were a bit more crucial, because there's the money question, right? The idea of having the money to actually buy new books or used books. And just librarians specifically were very pivotal for me as far as sort of introducing me to different texts, right? One incident in particular, maybe me walking into a library 9 times, picking up Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin, and reading, like, a page, and hoping no one saw me, and then putting it back, yeah? So what a lovely day when the librarian who saw me do that 9, 10, 11, 12 times said, hey, you know, you can check this fucking book out, and, like, nobody cares. Like, it'll just be, it's just a very good thing that you can do. So in that
Did you check it out?
No, I had a friend check it out for me, and I was like, I didn't tell him what it was about. I was just like, yeah, just do me the solid, and, you know, we'll make it up later. But even in that respect, I mean, I think that it was libraries specifically that were very helpful, friends specifically that were very helpful, because even once I did have access to not explicitly and both implicitly queer narratives, there was the question of, like, do you see yourself in the narratives that you're reading, right? Like, irrespective of whether I'm reading, like, Christopher Isherwood, or if I'm reading Tennessee Williams or Truman Capote or Edmund White, which are all lovely, important narratives and very pivotal as far as the scope of queer narrative arcs are concerned. It's like, okay, but, like, where am I, right? Or where are people who are like me, or where are people who don't fit a certain body mold? Where are trans folks? I didn't read literature with trans folks until very, very late in my reading timeline, I suppose you could say. And the question becomes, okay, now that I'm reading about these specific communities, like, who within those communities am I reading about, and why is it these specific demographics inside of those communities? Mm-hmm. So libraries were very helpful. Friends were helpful as far as passing different texts around. Like, what helped you get through this certain point in your life? What are you really enjoying? So word of mouth, I think, was deeply crucial to me. I didn't really have a queer bookstore or a feminist bookstore in my immediate vicinity, or I certainly didn't until, like, not very long for me, but maybe for y'all, like, a bit longer, because I'm an actual child up here, but maybe, for, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So even in approaching those for the first time was a sort of like a tiny explosion in my head, you know? So it, I think all of those things were very important for me, specifically like those spaces, right? Like having, even more so than the books maybe even, just like having an actual like third space that you can go and just sort of have these ideas just sort of congregate and sort of multiply. And that gives you the opportunity to go out and do whatever you need to do with them or write the narratives that you would like to write. Just sort of coming back to that idea of just like knowing that they exist is a lot in and of itself, even if you don't know specifically what you're looking for. Just knowing that, okay, other people are doing things that I am interested in or things that I would like to see or things that I can see myself in was deeply important for me.
Do you think you might have become less involved in or passionate about fan fiction spaces had there been these sort of like physical locations in your neighborhood that you could gather in?
No, I don't think I would have, right? So if we're going to return to like the question of sex, because we started talking about
that.
And I really like talking. So
let's just talk about that.
Even in the queer literature that I was reading, even if the characters were explicitly queer within the certain timelines that they were written, there was not, no one was really fucking, or if they were fucking, it was like under a very veiled language, right? Like there would just be a sort of like page break, and you know, it took me years to realize like, oh, they fucked like during, you know, the halfway through the page. So reading about sex with the sorts of people that I wanted to read about sex from, with the bodies that I wanted to read about sex from, you know, I really only got that from fan fiction specifically. And not just like the reading about sex, but also reading about sex for the sake of pleasure, right? Like, I think there's a certain way of writing about sex. And, you know, my initial reading about sex, it was mostly cis dudes that were writing it, and it fit a very specific narrative arc, right? Like, if you were to take something like Personal Matter, let's say, by Kenzo Burooe, like, this idea of, like, a man meeting a cis woman, and she's just sort of a vehicle for him to discover something about himself, and he's very special, and he's very proud at the end, and that's the end of, like, the sexual escapade, right? So it becomes, okay, what happened to the woman, right? Where was the pleasure for both parties? And the idea of pleasure was more blatant, I suppose, when I was reading narratives that were written by folks in parallel communities or folks who were in the same communities that I was, because I think that pleasure in text is just like so great and special and important, right? I think like one of the first narratives that I read where like I read it and I was like, okay, like this person fucked and they got fucked and they like really enjoyed it, and it was just like A++ for everyone was the end of just like ++. The was Justin Torres's We the Animals, which is a really, I suppose you could call it like a fraught narrative if you weren't from the community he was writing about, but at the very end, the protagonist has a sexual experience, and the framing of the story is such that it reads as if though it's, you know, a very traumatic thing, but you know, he's very happy at the end that this is something that he had and he derived pleasure from it. I think that Garth Greenwell is working in the same vein, right? He just had a story in the New Yorker not very long ago whose name I don't really remember, but it's
The Frog King.
Yeah. Two young men go on a vacation and there is pleasure throughout the text. I would have really enjoyed having something like that and seeing that and saying, okay, like, okay, so they're not one of them isn't going to die at the end, right? Or both of them aren't going to die at the end, or like they're not going to finally realize their love for one another, and then one gets stabbed and, you know, he's smiling as he reads the final letter, you know, as he slowly dies. So that, you know, the idea of pleasure was more present in these sort of inter and intra community works that were being written, at least for my end.
Lesbians always end up like crazy or murderous in like so many films that I used to work at the Video Shift, which you would know, for 8 years. It was a great job in Balmain. And for me, it was we had a queer screen section that people would come from all over Sydney for this section, because at that time it was pre, you know, streaming, and it was pre DVD. It was just VHS. And it was a really good queer screen section. But it seemingly all the lesbians just, like, they either died or they became completely psychotic.
Or straight.
Or they killed themselves, or just straight.
Or they just
and
kind
this,
of...
I mean, that was obviously the most devastating result, wasn't it?
Holly, you spoke about your sort of coming-of-age books being like oranges aren't the only fruit, and even cowgirls get the blues. And I wondered if you would tell us about the role sex played in those books for you.
Well, I just remember Even Cowgirls Get the Blues because Tom Robbins, is it Tom? I get confused with him and Tim. Tom Robbins was really in vogue in the 90s, like in the late 90s when I was in high school. Everyone thought that he was like really kooky and like this. He was this really trendy writer, I feel like, for my age group. And then that was obviously like a really nice surprise in that book. But it was super male-gazy. Like it never really felt that authentic to me. And I remember reading it and wanting it to be better, I guess. And then when I read Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, it was so much better. And I felt really good about that. But I felt like I felt so strongly this lack of narratives that, you know, that let people love each other in a way that doesn't end in kind of like craziness or death or something. It is a great lack. And when I wrote Goodwood, that was the first novel I wrote, I just really wanted to write a story that didn't end like that. And I know because you think, like you say, when you say, I wish that I'd had that, like I kind of wanted to write a book that I wish that I'd had. But yeah, I just think it is a really interesting thing that seems to happen. And when it doesn't happen, you have this real feeling of celebration, like, oh, wow, it actually worked out. And it seems like in the last like 5 years even, I feel like there's just that little bit more of it. Like White Houses, that book by Amy Bloom. I don't know if anyone read that about Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok. I just thought that was just the most beautiful book. And even though it's not, it doesn't, you know, it just has a lot of sadness at the end. You just get so much love in it, and it's just really beautiful to just feel that coming out of the page.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to go to questions in a minute.
But I have something to say about sex.
I was
going to
throw to you. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, what did you want to ask me?
No, I want to do this instead.
Anyway, so...
Sex is good.
No, I was thinking about this earlier. So I also worked in a queer bookstore, Different Light Books in San Francisco. And when I worked there, one of the things that we sold with great regularity were these massive photo books, usually of cis white men. And there was the only exception in terms of, like, at the time, I was looking for some sign that anybody wanted Asian people for anything. And unfortunately, the only thing that I could find at first was a magazine that seemed to be oriented to white men who wanted boyish Asian men. And it was a magazine called OG that many of you may recall. But that magazine led me to the comics and illustrations of Sadao Hasegawa, which was a Japanese gay artist who did pornographic illustrations, comics. He was a big influence on Tagame, whose work I also became really important to me. There was this really interesting part of it, which is that... the penis was often censored, so it would be a blur on the page, like a white blur, sometimes a white shadow in the middle of what was an otherwise an explicit scene. But it was something that allowed me to at least experience a different part of myself. It was a powerful... thing, and also to think about the way in which, you know, was I interested in S&M? Was I interested in those kinds of power plays? Was I interested in all of that stuff? So it was, it ended up being a whole education that I hadn't anticipated at the time, in addition to everything else. And also, Pat Califia would come into the store. And that was always exciting. Dorothy Allison also. There were all these writers who I ended up looking up to, many of them lesbian, who were writing works that were both literary and sexual, and challenging norms of all kinds in the process. And that also became part of how I thought about the work that I would end up writing.
Yeah, fantastic. Last question from me. This has been like a bit manic. Like, this is, I've like one third of the way through the questions, but I think it's been fun. Anyway, Andrew, so your mother gave you a book when you were 18 on writing by Rita Mae Brown, whose advice to gay male writers was, you have to be better than everyone else.
Which is so strange coming from a lesbian writer that she doesn't give that advice to women somehow.
Well, why do you think that, I mean, is that advice true for gay writers? And why do you think that that advice stayed with you to the point that
it was someone who knew, and I didn't even know I was gay, I think, when she gave me this book, and my mother did not know she was gay.
Oh, lovely.
But you all know now, so. My mom was signaling something to me she didn't know, and I was picking up a signal. It's the same thing about these books that are giving us some signal, but here was something specifically saying to me, it's going to be hard. There's going to be a challenge for you. And I don't know why at that time she thought it was harder for gay men than for a lesbian. Not quite sure. She had other weird advice, like learn Greek. That was important.
Did you?
No.
Oh.
No. Unless that was a signal, too, of some kind. Yeah. I mean, I think that's... All of us had to learn Greek. Now I get it. Thanks, Mom.
Eureka.
Alexander the Great. I think all of us had to hit a moment where we were like, I guess I have to be better. Yeah, learn Greek. I have to be better. Yeah. Certainly better than everyone else. I don't know what that is, but like... even better than I was, because they're not going to pay attention unless I'm like even better than all the guys that are getting attention already. I think it was true. Yeah,
I think so too. Well, best of the best are up on stage here tonight. We're going to do questions. I've got so many more if you don't. What about something really embarrassing? No? Okay, sure. I mean, you've had an hour to think of it, but we'll keep going. Geordie, I wanted to come back to you. No. One of the texts you mentioned to me was Deluc's La Batarde, and I wanted to ask you what your experience of that book was like.
Okay, I could answer this question about Violette Leduc's La Batarde. It again has to do with bathrooms and toilets. It's a much longer question. I would like to
what
pick
would you
up,
rather say?
Well, I've been silently developing a theory about Andrew while we've been sitting. Well, and I have a question for... Well, because it was so perfect. And okay. I have been thinking about something on my own, which is possibly the effect of jet lag and delirium, which has to do with the theory of Gilles Deleuze, the French philosopher, about sadomasochism. And... it's a huge reduction of the argument, but basically for him it has to do with narrative, who controls the narrative. And the masochist is the one, we are familiar with this concept of topping from the bottom. Deleuze did not use this concept, but he talks about the masochist or the bottom, and maybe that's an unfair compression, but at any rate, being the one who demands a narrative, and the top is the one who produces it. So it's kind of a switch of the power dynamic. And I have been thinking about children being read to. You mentioned this kind of sexualized aspect of them. If anyone knows, you know, children are very adamant about being read to. There's a really an erotic desperation / demand. I'm not saying that you were a demanding bottom as a 4-year-old, but I'm wondering about this scenario. And no, like, so part of it, yes, is this attachment. No, I've got more to say, Andrew, and I have questions. So this attachment to the idea of the seeing the penis, I understand that was a very, you know, rocked you to your core. But also, I wonder if there's something just erotic about kind of demanding, now it turns out your mother was a lesbian, demanding the narrative, you know, and getting it. Then that's this very erotic scenario. And then you say you love macho sluts. It's also perfect. It's coming together in a weird perfect way, and I don't even know what the question is, but...
Learn Greek.
I do you have anything to say to this?
Do you want to write
a reply? I'm glad I wore leather.
Yes, no, there's...
I don't have an perfect answer for that.
No, but I mean, you're very
much... That was
much
so well said.
I'm just thinking a lot about the four-year-old you and the you now.
You know, when I thought about macho sluts, I was like, there's
it's obviously you liked it.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's there.
That's
yeah.
all
we
I
don't
can
even
say.
Have to talk about it anymore.
Yeah. Well, then,
some self-discovery. Did we have a question come together? We were just... Oh, here we go. I'll just repeat the question. So the panelists talked about... texts that have been lacking, and so they've been asked what texts they'd like to see more of in the future.
Or actually what we're writing, isn't it?
Oh, what do you want to write? Yeah. Beg pardon.
Well, I'll jump in. I'm working on a story cycle that might become a novel, but is probably just interconnected short stories about two gay men, one white, one Korean-American. The stories go from before they've met to when they meet and fall in love and then become boyfriends, break up, get back together, break up again, go on to other men. It's a kind of, it doesn't fit a kind of typical novelistic structure in certain ways, but it might still end up being a novel somehow. And I'm trying to trace out what I think of as being the way in which a relationship, a gay relationship can stay with you sometimes for decades after it is over. I mean, maybe it's any relationship, but in particular, just the strange filaments of all of that is what I'm trying to trace out.
Yeah, wonderful. Would anyone else like to speak to that question?
Well, I'm going to say the challenge for me is to think about who I'm leaving out of my narratives, but then also whose stories I have a right to tell, and sort of teasing out how I'm going to open up the world without sort of trying to make puppets out of the characters. And that's just sort of what's in my head about what I have a duty to do and have an urge to do and a responsibility as well.
Speaking about reading books to children, I'm not going to feel the same way about it now when I read to my daughter tomorrow night. But also I feel, this is not something I feel like I'm going to write in the next little while, but it's really great when you find children's books that are really representative of different family structures, because it's difficult being a queer parent and having, knowing that your kid, you know, when they start to get to that almost at school age, and then they're going to know that they're from a family that is different. And like, her eyes just light up when I say that other kid has two mums too. Like, she just kind of, it's this feeling of her belonging, which is really, it's just so palpable. And so for me, I guess as well, for children of queer families as well, it's sort of, there seems to be a lack of books. I mean, it's all great to have the sex books, like the first love books for people coming out, but then there's also like the next stage when you're actually in a family with queer parents or family structures that are made up of all different types of scenarios. And I must say, I struggle to find novels for myself that represent that in a kind of casual way that kind of feels like it's not a huge deal. So maybe that's something that I'll think about doing at some point. I haven't myself, but if anyone has any recommendations for me, please let me know.
I think I'd like to see more romantic comedies, to be quite honest. Yes. Like, I'd like to see more rom-coms. I think that
queer people can be very funny. Like, we can be funny. But you wouldn't, you fucking know it. But you wouldn't think so from a lot of contemporary literary fiction. Like, I'm editing a novel. The novel that I'm editing with my editor right now is trying to work with that structure and also the idea of like a sort of polyamorous relationship, because I don't even think that we've gotten into the question of what it looks like when you leave a monogamous relationship within a sort of queer paradigm, for better or worse. I guess we haven't brought it up. But I think I'm really interested in the different forms that those relationships can take. I mean, Alex just talked a little bit about it, how you can be in a relationship and have it just sort of exist past the paradigm of like, okay, like now we're living together, okay, now we're gonna grow old together. Like, you could, you know, you could live with someone for a little while, or maybe you just fuck once or twice, and yet they remain in your life for quite a long time. So I'm really interested in what that sort of space can look like, partly just because of that rom-com idea, and also like the idea of like pleasure. Like, what happens when, like, can you just have like a narrative where you can read it and I don't want to feel as if though at some point someone's gonna die, you know? I don't want to feel as if though like something tragic is going to happen. Like, can I read a narrative with the types of folks that I want to see, Black, Brown, Asian American, and so on, and I don't feel as if though tragedy is around the corner? And if you have that narrative, then like, what is the narrative thrust of it, right? Like, if that tragedy is not sort of propelling the conflict, then like, what is? Like, can you have like something just be funny with queer folks and just have it exist and have that just sort of be a novelistic structure? So I'd like to see more of that in the future. I think it would be really cool.
I have like a fantasy about what it's has nothing to do with books, but has to do with movies. I'm just going to put it out there because I really want it to happen. But James Bond, I have an issue, and I just I feel like they could just leave James Bond alone and just put like a super sexy butch chick as James Bond, and right? Because it would just change. But this is an audition. No, but I just feel like you know, I'm really interested in what it is about masculinity and its sexiness, and it also is kind of like all of its like celebration and the cavalierness and the freedom of it. And you know, we have so many mythologies and iconographies around kind of like these men, most of them are white, and they're just kind of like walking around, and I'm just like, just put like, I mean, it anyway, Caster Semenya is on my mind. She's a phenomenal athlete.
I'm asking you about her tomorrow.
Yeah, okay, cool.
But we can do it again. Yeah, we'll
but like Caster Semenya is just like, she's like this fucking handsome, butch, South African, super sexy. I'm like, put her as James Bond. Like, she would just kill it. And also, it changes the dynamic around the women in there, because right now they're just kind of like, they don't dare let another James Bond movie come out because they're like, ooh, how are we gonna do it, you know? And I just am like, put a chick in it. Just put a chick and a bunch of like gay men and like put, so like just like make it, because we have so much language around, and I love that all of us have been so involved in like and inspired by graphic novels, because I think that in graphic novels there's so much permission that's given that isn't existing in the human human form. Like, all of us have had to go look for who we are, what we look like, who likes us, what is desire, and I just feel like sometimes the mainstream can be so oppressive, and I love those moments when we manage to like just get in there. Like, your book Less was everywhere, and I'm just like, does everyone know it's about gay men, you know? I could just, and it's like this beautiful cover of this guy in a suit, like, I know, the blue suit, like, falling from the sky, and I'm like, everyone's picking this up, and it's gay men, you know? But I just think that these opportunities to enter into the mainstream or kind of just, like, contribute to how these ideas get made and just, like, make James Bond, keep it James. You don't even have to change the name.
Right? It's an idea all ready to go, packaged up.
There you go.
And now, so when you wrote your book, you were already doing this, I imagine. You were, you were writing the thing that you wanted to be put into the world. And what do you think is going to follow in the wake of Crimson?
Well, I remember traveling to Denmark to a writer's school. And the teacher asked me, the next book, is it going to be about a Greenlander as well? And he was very negative. So she told me indirectly that if all your work is going to be like about a Greenlandic queer something, I'm not going to read it because it's if you can't write about anything else, you're not a writer. So I said, hell yeah, I'm going to do that.
That was the boom moment.
Yeah.
You were on it.
No, because I remember that day very clearly, because that's the day I decided that all the books I'm going to write in the future are going to be like about indigenous, strong, maybe also queer women who, because all I see when I see indigenous or like it's a black friend, it's a gay friend, it's a Gadadal friend, which is our race, and I'm just extremely provocated by it. So I'm just gonna write about all the indigenous people, indigenous women I know, and that's what I'm gonna keep doing. In my next novel, I think. But since I already wrote the queer book, I'm going to write about something else, the next one. I'm going to talk about suicide because it's a really extreme, huge, like a huge problem in Greenland. Yeah. So that's very important to me. I think I'm going to talk about a lot of difficult issues. And so.
Did you get thank yous from queer people in Greenland?
Oh, yes, yes.
Very nice.
And I got to kiss a lot of them, too.
I literally just got to Sydney.
You just come here
to
brag.
I just wrote the only queer... I mean, you're amazing. It's like... I wrote the only queer book in Greenland. I'm happy to kiss you. Don't even worry about it.
You should try in passing marriage equality. It also works.
I know. Does it work?
Just a joke.
Congratulations.
I just wanted to... We'll do a last round and kind of tie this all together. So... We have spoken a little bit about the texts and characters and authors and stories that have inspired each of you. Have those stories and experiences shaped the way you write and what you write about, or not really? Let's start down this end.
Oh man, I have to start with Jordy.
What? you've just started us off every time. Go.
Okay, it's only fair because I put you on the spot too. I've had zero time to think about the answer to this question. Since I talked about Delaney, I'll just say, you know, he has a fabulous book called About Writing that's like writing advice. It's one of the best books on writing that I've ever read. And one of the lines in there that really stuck with me where he was talking about trying to orient yourself toward producing a certain affect in the reader. And he says something like, when we're writing fiction, we're trying to write a false memory with the force of history. And to make the reader believe, you know, feel that they have a memory of something when they're reading this narrative and it feels historically true to them, that they've almost experienced it. Thinking about how to use the structures of genre fiction. I mean, the elements of actually of humor writing is what I'm working on now and totally is interesting to me, but also the elements of thriller, you know, the elements of sort of plot structure to produce feeling in the reader rather than at a sentence level per se, rather than you could make your sentences as beautiful as possible, but really I'm very interested in the architecture. So I think I do try to take that from Delaney.
Yeah, great.
That was a good answer right off the top of your head.
What about you, Brian?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about, I mean, Alex mentioned Gengo Rotagame, and he has a graphic novel series called My Brother's Husband, where it's about a two-person family unit in Japan, a father and a daughter, and the father's brother had moved to Canada because he was gay and it's difficult to be queer in Japan. He married, and the person that he married came back to Japan to meet what was left of his family after his husband died. And it is a narrative that has tragedy as its base, but it isn't rooted in tragedy. Mm-hmm. And that is deeply interesting to me, this idea of like writing against tragedy. So that is always on my mind. And also I think since I mentioned Giovanni's room, it's been on my mind because Gabrielle Bello wrote an essay just about the idea of like despair in Giovanni's room. But the passage that really sticks with me is like the first 15 pages where the narrator is recounting his first love, like his first sexual escapade. And it's a very bright moment, a very bright series of passages. And then it ends in despair immediately. Just sort of the recognition that like, oh shit, like I'm in bed with another cis male. Like what will befall me? Like what woe will become unto me? And that's something that's always stuck with me, because just that idea of like, once you read that, I mean, if that's all that you read, it's largely going to affect like how you view yourself, how you view the relationships that you're in, how you view the relationships that you can write and iterate. So I think writing towards that, but also writing against it. So with those two ideas in mind, just the idea of like writing against despair and like what that can look like.
Yeah, great. What about you, Holly?
What was the question again?
So the text you put forward. So
I got really involved in these answers. Sort of, yeah. I was really enjoying both of these.
Just sort of your queer inspirations. Has that affected the books that you've written?
Not really. Yeah, no, definitely. With the first book I wrote with Goodwood, probably more than I'd even thought about with The Member of the Wedding, because that kind of really just turned me on to that type of writing in general. Like I just was really interested in I guess like mid-century American writing. It just really spoke to me, and in the phrasing, I guess. But also I was really interested in humour, and like In Cold Blood was really influential to me as well when I was writing that book. And just, you know, the Capote's voice in that, how it's kind of very swishy, as I think someone said, described him as before. But yeah, I think definitely those things were probably quite obviously influenced in my first book. But I think in some ways, in the next book, not so much, and probably not again now. But I don't know, like in terms of writing a novel, I kind of wanted to, you know, when you sort of the first one, maybe it's all like you combine everything you've ever loved and you want to put it all in one book or something. But yeah, I mean, I think subliminally, yes, of course, and things that I would consume now all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. In case
I also think a lot about what you were saying in terms of what story do you have a right to say and right to tell. I think about that all the time. It's a really difficult question.
Yours is Godspeed is a memoir.
Yep.
But in terms of, because it's written in a quite a stylized way, I think, if that's the right way of putting it. It's like poetry.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about poetry, and I was thinking about the books that influence me now, and to like writers like Eileen Miles, who's a poet.
Miles, who we had last year.
Right? And last year. And again, Alfreda Jelinek and Herta Mueller, and they have a way of writing that is just kind of very specific and stark, and they hold the humanity of their characters through the kind of like very austere brutality of their language choice. And so when I think about the text that I brought to the panel, which is like Dykes to Watch Out For and Stone Butch Blues and Macho Sluts, my queerness informs a lot of how I engage in settings like this. Like it doesn't, you know, because I think that what I've learned from community and the way I was raised up is it's like, it's interdisciplinary, it's intersectional, and there's so I find that canon of queer literature is often more useful in its friendliness when I am in, when it's not in the writing, but when I'm in the storytelling in real time, connecting to real people across this divide. But when it's in the writing itself, for now, it has become something else, yeah.
Okay, great. How about you, Nivia?
Right now I'm reading a lot of, there's
in Europe, there's you know, about the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of poets who write about racism and all this theme about not belonging, which is also a theme in my first book. So I'm reading a lot of poetry about not belonging, about being a different, a wrong color, kind of, in a white society. So that's what's been very interesting to me lately. But I think the reason that I'm interested in it is because of this theme, not belonging, which is very extremely broad, and which is something that, which is what maybe also what made my first book very universal, is because it's what everyone feels some point in their lives. So that's, we have great, great, great poets in Scandinavia right now, so you should really check that out.
Beautiful. Yeah. We've got 30 seconds left, so do you want to just give us quick answers?
Well, I was just thinking of what to say about that, and is Hasegawa in my text in some way, or is Tagame in my text? And I think actually, so this kind of possible novel that I was talking about earlier, there is a lot of sex in it. Some of it is S&M. There are Asian bodies in it. There are. It's also a novel of, I would say, gay middle age, which is not what I was inspired by, but is what I'm thinking about now.
What's that?
No reason. So.
Yeah, great. And what about you?
Macho sluts made me the man I am today.
Beautiful. Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming to Gay for Paige.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.